Well, dear Ansgar, I'm so grateful. It is always very difficult to listen to these eulogies because you have to live up to them, of course. And I have to do that today, and particularly when I have to talk in English about so much. I thought, well, if I was a student, I would say, oh, heavens, what is all this? But unfortunately, since the 1960s, we have had such an enormous array of new trends in theory. And I was asked to give a survey of the development of literary theory 1960 to 2010. Now, in this lecture, I'm not only supposed to give you a survey, but I will also make you aware of the fact that in the domain of the study of literature, theory tends to be, and that is also in my title, tends to be coming in turns. That is, in trends, one could almost say. If I had to deal with the previous half century, from 1910 to 1960, my task would be so much easier, because I would have to talk about no more than two major kinds of theory. A predominantly biographical, historical one until the 1930s, the late 1930s, and then after that, what was there was what you still find today, particularly in France, the life and letters approach. And then came the new criticism from the 1930s to the 60s and 70s. But since then, things have changed. They have changed indeed so much so that theory having been coming in turns will hardly be a new insight for anyone who has observed the field in recent decades. Now, to what extent this is a case, I was made aware of when I came across Doris Bachmann-Medig's recent book on cultural turns, in which she deals with no fewer than seven different ones in the domain of cultural theory and criticism alone from the last few decades. Now, with so many turns taken in so short a time, she is understandably led to the question with their appearance on the scene, what their appearance on the scene actually implies. Are they evidence of the fact that the process of theoretical investigation has speeded up so much because it has developed such an enormous dynamic? Or are they the product of unpredictable shifts in intellectual fashion, as suggested by the French sociologist Pierre Bourdieu in his essay Haute Couture or Haute Culture? That is, does the theory of culture change as fashion? I mention this only briefly because I will not be dealing here with causes or origins, but more or less exclusively with these turns themselves, and with their consequences, with what it means when in the domain of the humanities and social sciences, theory has been coming in turns. Now, what we can observe in the field of literary theory is that out of a plurality of proposals for a new theoretical orientation, at one time, one seems to appeal to a great number of researchers, is then taken up by them, and then thus may lead to a new turn, especially when the theory that is in place has been around for some time, and a new generation of scholars interested in theory becomes fascinated by the American maxim, make it new. As regarding many other aspects of our Western culture, this desire for change has also grown in the domain of literary and cultural theory, with the result that instead of a lifetime of half a century or more, a new turn at best can hope for a career of a decade. Usually a new theoretical turn is introduced with the modest stance of claiming no more than heightened attention to a perspective, to an aspect, or approach that is held to be unduly neglected. But soon there can be observed that there can be observed the tendency to then transform the newly introduced descriptive terms into operative categories and to greatly enhance their dissemination by metaphoric use, so that the new vocabulary, as the American philosopher Rorty said, is meant to replace rather than to enrich or refine the one that is in place. Replace, and therefore turns. The question is, however, what such aiming at substitution instead of supplementation means for the relevance of theory, because mere substitution does not necessarily imply progress, but can also mean that just as much gets lost as what is gained. In order to create some common ground for the discussion of these questions by pointing out what regularly gets lost by the usual procedure of substitution, I will call to mind those major theoretical shifts or turns that have occurred in the humanities since the advent of the end of the new criticism. That event, the new focusing on the individual text by what came to be called close reading, was the first major shift in criticism away from the old biographical approach that had been in place, just imagine, since the 18th century. There were almost, 1.5 centuries, almost 2 centuries, one paradigm. Now, I thought it would be best I say a few words about the new criticism before I come to talk about new trends in Literaturwissenschaft from the 1960s onwards. Because I want to inform you about what the situation was like at that time, what kind of literary theory and accompanying kind of literary criticism in Britain and the United States, and since the 1950s also in German Anglistik, dominated the academic teaching. It was a theory that was meant to grant literature, and especially poetry, an extremely important status and function, because it was held to be a domain inside a world of technology and senseless materialism in which humanist and aesthetic values could still be found. Though the basic principles of this approach were first developed in Britain, in particularly by I.A. Richards in his work The Principles of Literary Criticism from 1924, it became better known under the name in which it developed in the United States in the 1940s and was then called the New Criticism. Also there, it were conservative critics who were opposed to the spreading materialism and came to be called Southern agrarians, who trusted that in literature, literature could serve as a balance, as a counterweight to the spreading technological worldview. The name for the movement was derived from a study by the poet and critic John Crow Ransom from 1941 that had the title The New Criticism. But the new practice had already been promoted by a book that became a sort of Bible for generations of American students, and I've put it on your list, from the late 1930s to the earlier 1970s. And that was called Understanding Poetry, an anthology for college students by Cleanse Brooks and Robert Penn Warren, first published in 1938. Now, the most important aspect of the theory was that everything that was really important was to be found in the literary texts themselves. And what was to be given up was the occupation with everything that was around it, extrinsic, as they called it, later called context, be it the artistic, cultural, social, political situation in which they were produced or were received and studied. This was also the reason why this kind of critical approach was called new, because what was dominant before, until the late 1930s, was largely a biographical criticism and a study of influences on the authors of literary works that came out of the 19th century craze for historical studies and origins. Instead of a theory of literary production, how did it all come about? The new criticism was then a critical practice based on a theory of the internal structure of literary works. It was a theory that was also implied that this internal structure and condition can be objectively studied by what came to be called close reading, something I recommend to you still today. A minute observation and analysis, especially of the language of poetry and the inner contradictions and harmonies to be found in poems. Now, the most famous example of this study was probably a book called The Well-Wrought Urn, Studies in the Structure of Poetry from 1947. And in order to substantiate the theoretical position that it is only what is in the text what counts, one had to reject what the author meant, on what the author meant to write or his intention, and the effect, especially the emotional effect on the readers as well. And this was done in two important essays by two critics, Wimsett and Monroe Beardsley. One was called The Intentional Fallacy. That is the wrong belief that by intention one can find out what the text is about. And the other is called the affective fallacy. The belief that when one looks at what the text does to the reader, one knows what is in the text. Both reprinted in Wimsett's book, The Verbal Icon, Studies in the Meaning of Poetry. Now, as the new criticism pays utmost attention to the form of literary text, it has later been characterized as a kind of formalism that also fitted in the overall view of structuralism that dominated then the study of both language and literature until the advent of post-structuralist theory. I will come to talk about this. Developed then in France in the 1960s and 70s. The approach of the new critics has also been criticized as being naive and regarding its objectivist belief ever since the advent of reader response theories. We also talk about that, the response of the readers. Yet, as it has to be admitted that it is practically impossible to describe and analyze a text in a perfectly objective and manner, without subjective interests of the investigator creeping in, and without that principle, epistemological decisions in the way of preconditions have been made, it is, on the other hand, rather meaningless to discuss the context of a text that has not been before closely observed and studied. So that a close reading appears to be absolutely indispensable even today, even when one knows that many personal and cultural and historical and ideological factors influence such a reading. The verdict that an objectivist investigation via a close reading is practically impossible is true. For the putting into practice of all and every literary theory. But the endeavor to closely focus on the text itself and its internal structure in a close reading will, in any case, let one see more than before, and will therefore be a much better basis for any discussion of a text's embedding and function in any kind of context. So even when a theoretical trend and its concomitant critical practice may look deficient from a perspective of a later theoretical stance, and that is very important, when we see what it didn't do, do not believe that it was just silly and that its followers were unfortunately not so clever and well-informed as we are. It is much wiser to not only point to the weaknesses of an earlier theoretical approach, though that has, of course, to be done, but also to keep in mind its strengths and try to still profit from them, especially in the domain of the humanities or cultural studies, where, as I'm attempting to show you, there exists rather a series of theoretical attempts to encircle and throw light on the various aspects of what we call literature and culture, rather that to, from all angles, rather than a straight line of progress, because, well, what one sees as a movement, as progress and regress, always depends on where you want to go. And where you want to go is the most problematic thing in the humanities. Now, the next turn from the new criticism to structuralism in the 1950s and 60s proved to be less incisive, because the structuralists also focused on the way language is organized. The most significant change being the shift from the study of a singular order to be found in one particular text to the inquiry into more general patterns, as these were to be found in genres, kinds of discourse, and other collective systems of signification. In linguistics, a structuralist approach was, of course, introduced much earlier, due to the posthumous publication of, and you may have heard that in other contexts, the Cours de Linguistique Générale by Ferdinand de Saussure in 1916. The most important features of Saussurean structuralism are the view, and it is important also for literary structuralism, that the meaning of language science is not determined by the relation to things or ideas outside language to which they refer, but the relation or their difference from and opposition to other signs in the system of language. For instance, left, right, up, down, dry, wet, rain, hail, snow, as versions of wet. There is a nice distinction between foreigner and stranger, and the sign that consists of a significant or of a signifiant, as he called it, a signifier, that is something like the letters of a word, and a word as, in its shape as it is. For instance, DS. There is a tiny bit of chalk still here. It's just very simple, DS. That's my example. For instance, DS, and the signifié, the signified, as Saussure says, the type of a big car in, by Citroën in the 1950s, is therefore in principle an arbitrary, although there are exceptions. That is, in this case, as I will soon explain, or with onomatopoetic words like cuckoo or hiss or sigh, there are a few words where there is another link, but important in general is only the position of a sign, of a language sign, inside the larger system of signs called by Saussure langue or language, in difference from all particular uses of language or individual texts. Now, what has that to do with what we are talking about, with literary and cultural theory? Now, structuralism became more encompassing with its application to other fields, especially first to anthropology, by studies by Claude Lévi-Strauss in his Anthropologie Structurale from 1958, but then, of course, also by a famous book where I took this example from, by Roland Barthes, Mythologie, 1957, translated Mythologies, and in German, Mythen des Alltags. What Lévi-Strauss assumed was the existence of an unconscious system of relations, unconscious, and that guarantees the coherence of our experience of the world. And as he used the structuralist method, he found in language studies, the link with the analysis of language remained quite strong. And one could say from there on, the whole 20th century was determined in philosophy largely by language. The link was even stronger in the well-known structuralist approaches to literature undertaken at that time by particularly French scholars like Lucien Goldman in his Pour une sociologie du roman, roman from 1964, Algernon Julian Grémache in his Sémantique structurale from 1966, Gérard Genet in his Figure from 1966 to 72, Tvetan Todorov, I could any name. Important is that just as the news critics before focused on poems, the structuralists largely focused on narratives, on the novel, on stories, on storytelling. Yet even beyond this, beyond the literary study in the narrower sense, structuralist thought was all over. It also influenced, for instance, Marxism. The Marxist philosopher Louis Althusser, you have him also on your list, whose structuring of the social world became widely known by his conception of the incisive influence of what he called cultural institutions. And these are not buildings, but, for instance, the education system, the legal system, and so on, and the medicine, Gesundheitssystem, or whatever. Now, it must not be forgotten that the structuralist turn was, after all, consolidated on the theoretical level by the further development of a theory of science that is much older, that came even from the 19th century with people like Charles Sanders Peirce and so on, but I'm not so much interested now in origins. What we get is another interesting name and work, of course, going with it, Umberto Eco. I'm going to talk also about that. Now, before that, in mythology, let me tell you, Roland Barthes, and I mentioned this, the title metaphor of an exhibition is taken from an exhibition that was called The Family of Man, to show the use of the word family and the emphasis on birth, work, death. Now, what makes up life, you know, birth, work, death? So it doesn't sound very attractive. And the emphasis on this was what all people have in common. And Barthes thought, well, yeah, this was made to give an impression of the human condition in the world as unchangeable. And therefore, it doesn't make sense actually to criticize it too much and seek for changes and so on. So it became political. Or he revealed the mythical value of things like beefsteak and pommes frites, or a car like the Citroën DS, which of course in French reads like DS, which means the goddess. It was a divine car. It was a divine car. And he had a semiological system where he says, well, we have language with words signifying something. And then on top of that, we build another system of signification where we have these extra meanings. He called the level of myth. He called this mythos, myth, because when you look at it very closely, you will find that it is invented but shared by so many people that it looks as if it was reality. Now, Umberto Eco has to be mentioned, and I mention him here within structuralism, as the one who focused on the founding of the concept of the sign in logic, information theory, and linguistics in his work, The Theory of Science and Theory of Semiotics, as he called it later and before. He came to expand the field of semiotics by including a complex theory of interpretation that is very important, that not only texts, but texts about texts are also structured in a particular way, and he drew attention to this. Structuralism was so strong in the 1960s, as I said, that it also influenced Marxist critics and theorists. Although in Marxist theory the structures of society and culture are held to be historically changeable, while in structuralism actually the underlying deep structures appear to be timeless, it doesn't really fit so well. Yet, the most influential structuralist leanings was the French philosopher Louis Althusser, already mentioned him, and important in his concept of social formation, there are rather autonomous levels, and the one of the ideological state apparatuses, as he calls them, as systems of education, jurisdiction, political institutions, and so on, are very important. And a large number of literary critics of that period work with this kind of theory. There was also another important sort of Marxist theory in the 1960s by the French critic Pierre Macharet in his theory of literary production, presented as an influential discussion of the Althusserian view to literary production. A literary text is a production in which a pre-given materials already there are worked out over without that its author is necessarily aware of all the implications of this process production. That is, you are born into the world, the language is already there, you come to the university, the books are already there, and you are influenced by all this for what you do yourself. You can't escape it. We can't escape it. And what we do in terms of invention, we have to do in spite of it and through it. Not away from it, but we have to muddle through and still do our own thing. I mention these things in between so that you don't get the impression that with all these theories, what finally can be done? What can we still do? We can still do a lot. Now, when finally elements of this structuralist theory were disseminated in the United States by Robert Scholes and Jonathan Culler, the structuralist turn was almost over on the continent here. It was a linguistic turn. And maybe for that very reason, the reflection on language, on how much our way, how we describe things, determines how it looks, fostered something that was then called post-structuralism. Post-structuralism in the sense that it came later, but also in the sense that it goes beyond it. A term leaving the decision graciously open, whether it means the one or the other. Now, post-structuralism was a wide movement that came into many, many areas. But before we come to discuss the more important version of post-structuralism, we have to deal with a theoretical turn relativizing the objectivist claims of structuralism. You see, in structuralism, I still believed we can do this to a certain point objectively. But particularly the German critics and theorists Hans-Georg Gadamer, Hans-Robert Jauss, Wolfgang Iser created what was called Rezeptionsästhetik or reception theory in the 1970s. Gadamer published in his work Wahrheit und Methode that in the interpretation of a literary work, what he called the horizon of the reader or interpreter is melted together with the horizon of meaning of the text, and that the result then is strongly influenced by the Vorverständnis, the pre-given knowledge of the readers. And this whole thing was based on the tradition of what's called in German particularly, and it's very strong in this country, of hermeneutik. Actually, the hermeneutic is the solving of riddles. something very difficult. We have to find our way in the darkness, in the wilderness. It implies that the literary work of art does not possess a timeless meaning, but offers the reader a chance for a new experience that is, can expand her or his perception and also cognitive faculties. Hans-Robert Jauss, for instance, meant something similar when he spoke about the Erwartungshorizont of readers, the horizon of expectations in a particular historical period. Thus, we can say that all interpretations of past literature can only be understood in a kind of approach to the past from and through our present consciousness of readers. And we can, in retrospect, even take into account previous approaches to a text that are later than the time when it was produced in a kind of whole Rezeptionsgeschichte, let's say from Shakespeare and Shakespeare in his own time, then Shakespeare in the 18th century, Shakespeare in the 19th century, in the 20th century, and at the beginning of the 21st. Now, Wolfgang Isers' main theoretical work in Rezeptionsgeschichte, in his work Der Akt des Lesens in German, Theorie ästhetischer Wirkung, or in English The Act of Reading, shows that his views are heavily dependent on the earlier work by a Polish philosopher called Roman Ingarden, and these works were already published in the 1930s, in particular Das literarische Kunstwerk from 1931. Going further than Gadamer and Jauss, Iser, just as Ingarden, presents the text as no more than a potential structure that has to be concretisiert by the readers, and that the readers will do this by using their own norms, values, knowledge of the world, and so on. So there is a steady process of, as they call it, aushandeln, negotiating between the power of the text to control the way it is understood and the reader's tendency to concretize it according to his or her own former experience. So a process then finally where also the experience of the readers will be modified by the text. Iser even distinguishes between various kinds of readers. I don't want to go much into details here, but there is something that gives readers a good chance to bring in their own conceptions, because texts are full of holes like a Swiss cheese. They have a lot of Leerstellen. They actually have more Leerstellen than Vollstellen when you look at it more closely. The text is only a kind of structure, and we in our Vorstellungskraft, in our mind, have to fill it out and make it colorful, make it full. And that is what actually reception theory wanted to point out. Also in the 1970s, the French semiotician Riffater published his Semiotics in Poetry, in which he attempted to show that in order to fully respond to a poem, it is not sufficient to possess the necessary linguistic competence, because in poetry the language often departs from the norms of normal discourse. The reader also has to have a literary competence. Now you can say, I start my studies and you slowly get literary competence, and then it becomes easier to read. Finally, I have to add that reader-oriented theory also has strong supporters in the United States. There is one book, has a strange title, by Stanley Fish, and he called that, "Is There a Text in This Class?" The authority of of interpretive communities. And what he thought was, is there one text in this class, or are there actually several ones? Because if there are people come from several cultural traditions, they will certainly read the text quite differently. So, what else? Before structuralism, the turn away from structuralism was therefore a very significant one, and it didn't happen everywhere. As I said, structuralism in literature was very much focused on narrative, and there it is still there and still very valuable. So it is not always a turn. A new turn does not always mean that the rest is forgotten and a turn away. Now, the most widely disseminated and most influential post-structuralist theory in the English-speaking world, and I assume also in France, has, however, been that presented by Jacques Derrida, also on your list. Indeed, so much so that the method of reading he termed deconstruction often has been used as a label for the whole post-structuralist turn. Deconstruction. Deconstruction. Now, what Derrida wanted to do was to, first thing as a philosopher, rewrite the whole history of Western philosophy, and I'm not going to go into that. But he also wanted to do something else. He was all against what he called logocentrism, the belief that there was an answer to our desire in Western thought since Plato to presuppose that there is some sort of stable center somewhere, a center of principle of unity for all the structures that we have and the multiplicity of the world and the self. And some people call it God, some man, some consciousness, some our purpose, der Welt als Wille und Vorstellung in 19th century philosophy, truth, Wahrheit, substance, essence, or sheer being, as the German philosopher Heidegger, das Sein. Now, according to Derrida, this whole desire for a center is so strong because it seems to guarantee being as presence, something you can see, it is there. Now, therefore, in language, we adhere to what Derrida calls phonocentrism, what you have here now, the belief that speech alone has full presence and that writing is only secondary. Now, the crucial tenet of Derrida's method of deconstruction, is to reverse this hierarchy. To say and to demonstrate that also speech is a form of writing, as he calls it, that structures have no center, and that we have to admit that presence cannot be reached, at least not in language, because, as he attempted to show in his paper La Différence, by introducing his most famous term, Différence. Now let me see, can I put this somewhere here? Now, this doesn't appear in a lexicon, because there is difference, but not différence. Now, he put this together because in English it is difficult to imitate, because differe in French means to differ, be different, and to defer, to delay, comes later. Because to make sure of the present meaning of a word in difference from other words, you have to wait to go on to other words. The article was reprinted in his famous work De la Grammatologie from 1967 of grammatology. I put this on the list. And I do not know whether Derrida was aware of the fact, and I want to explain for you what it means, that the famous Russian-American author Vladimir Nabokov had already some years earlier in his parodistic novel Pale Fire from 1962 given a striking parodistic example of the intricate linking of difference and deferral, of difference, in what he calls it word golf. When you look in the index of that novel under word golf, You read see less. Now you go to less, under L, less. It says see mass. Now you go to mass, and it says under mass, then see male. You go to male, and under male, finally, and at the same time, not finally, but beginning again, you see word golf. So you can go through the lexicon, an English lexicon, which is not English-German, but English-English. And you don't know any English. You can go through the whole word, you won't find a single explanation, because all you get is other words for one word. And then you don't know the other words, you look up the other words. And you go through the whole word. This is what Derrida gets at. Now, what else? There was, of course, in France a lot going on at that time. And I wonder how much to tell you, but of course Derrida knew quite well that his own method was also valid for what he himself did. And he saw the way out by combining philosophical with literary discourse. He started to write something like literature, because he knew that literature itself is already deconstructed. Already Philip Sidney in the 16th century said, the poet nothing affirmeth and therefore never lieth. That is, he doesn't boast to have said something real, therefore he can't lie. So, at any rate, Derrida's writing style and manner of argumentation have been responsible for an extremely uneven reception. There are still today strong believers of Derrida. There are others who think, no, well, all what he did was not really sound. I'm not going into that. What is important is that strong theories like Derrida's, and we'll soon find another one, have create fans, create even sectarians, people who believe every word of what the important critic has said, and they come close to sectarian religion, where the only thing that counts is whether one is a believer or not, rather than testing over philosophical theory. It's very difficult to discuss with some such people, because they only think, as soon as they spot that you don't believe, they think it's not worthwhile. It's very difficult. This has to be said because it also applies to other things, like what I'm going to talk about now, for instance, people like Jacques Lacan, the psychologist, the French one, and Deleuze and Guattari. Now, all this comes from France in the 60s, I can't help it. And 70s, and there are Lacanians, believers in Lacan, there are Deleuzians who think they have understood everything their master has said, and although what they have written is very difficult to understand sometimes. And I will mention a few of the writings because they have been very important and influential, and they have dominated literary criticism to a large extent. Lacan, and you have him on your list, among the post-structuralists. He was a French psychologist who developed a kind of unorthodox Freudian theory. And one of the most important things is that he speaks about the way we develop language as a child, and there is what he calls the mirror phase. There is a certain point between being 1 year old or 3 year old. You look at a mirror and you finally see something, somebody there, and you discuss. You discover this is yourself. When you move, this picture also moves, and you find there is something like self-reflection that starts. Very important, because it has much to do with what is then being developed. And it is a very difficult matter to really explain what he did. He then came to the impression that it was language that was important, that would structure everything that this child begins to understand. And from an epistemological point of view, there is a question one could ask: how does he know that exactly? But it isn't important at this moment, because there it remains important that he explained what Freud calls das Unbewusste, the unconscious, as structured, as he called it, like a language. That is, you understand that there is no center. There is no definite meaning. There are only relations between different words, and there are also only relations between different parts in the unconscious. And therefore, we have to see this as a language which then is taught by society. You grow up in a certain culture and you learn the language that is there, and you learn with that language also your unconscious presuppositions, your unconscious feelings even. He calls that the name of the father because he thinks that language comes from the father. I'm not going into this gendering of the language of Lacan, which is feminists have written a lot about it, and it's very difficult. And of course, he also has a symbol for the language, for the powerful language, which is a phallus, and he has this is all sex metaphor coming from Freud, but by Lacan turned in a different direction. I must say, it has brought about a large number of criticisms of literature, and there are people who swear this is the very thing. I only mention this. I'm not too knowledgeable about this. I have read some of it. Some of it has to me seemed very opaque. I can't share much of it. I just make you aware this is there, and it is, of course, also very interesting because we always try to get hold of the unconscious. We don't like that it is not easily accessible. He was one of those who tried to do this, who tried to make us appear. And that was also, to a certain extent, true of two people. You have also on your list Deleuze and Guattari. They published one book that made a scandal. That was called L'Anti-Oedipe, the Anti-Oedipus, Capitalism and Schizophrenia. Now, schizophrenia is that, of course, you know, this is a terrible illness where a person suddenly does not control anymore all parts of the consciousness, so that they become separate. You could say there is then suddenly two persons in one because they are not linked anymore. This is a terrible thing, and he thinks that our society, that late capitalist society, is just of this kind. Just think about it and read Deleuze, and you will find it's very interesting to have this kind of view, because there are so many things we have now. You see, when you are in medicine, you are in medicine. When you are in the natural sciences, you are in the natural sciences. When you are a lawyer, you think like a lawyer. And all these things are so much separate. So sociologically spoken, this is, and literature, and this is very interesting, literature is something where you find everything. Literature is something where these discourses are still combined. And Deleuze and Guattari also answered to maybe some of the problems of our own time. Now I know I have to concentrate. There's a long way to go, but of course some of the things I will have to tell you this. There are parts of my survey where I have seen that in the next few weeks somebody else will speak about a certain development, a certain trend, a certain turn more in detail. About these things I will just inform you generally in a few sentences. Others, where I've seen that they don't talk about, I say more about. So my lecture is not overall just even. It is a little bit part of this Vorlesungsreihe, of this important kind of survey of recent developments in our own Anglistik and Kulturwissenschaft. Now, my concentration on the European scene on Paris made me first a little bit blind, but of course I still have to say something about France, and I still have to mention one critic I haven't talked about, and besides Derrida, perhaps the most important one, and that is Foucault. And you have him on your list as well. And he, as a philosopher and historian, and one could say cultural historian, has been interested mostly in what he calls historical transformations, changes in our worldview, changes in sciences, changes in our knowledge. He began by writing about Folie des Raisons in 1961, Madness and Civilization is the English title. And then the Naissance de la Clinique, the birth of the clinic. And he showed the intricate connection between historically valid form of knowledge accompanying orthodox discourse and social control and institutions in the domains of psychiatry and medicine. We have this now in the large discussion about Schulmedizin and alternative Verfahren and so on. I mean, it's not totally gone, you know. And in this widely influential work from 1966, he called The Order of Things. I take the English title. The original title is Les Mots et les Choses. And it is, he presented something very important, a historical overview of the changes of the entire systems of knowledge in Western civilization since the times of classical antiquity. And these systems, he saw in terms of changes between large phases, he called episteme. Now, episteme, or whatever, is a period. A period with certain practices, not only of language, but also of institutions, of sciences, of everything. The simplest way is to say this. What can you say today before people say you are crazy? In any kind of science, there are rules. Within that frame, and important is not whether it is the truth what you say, you can sometimes maybe were ahead of your time, but sometimes maybe it's really crazy, it's difficult to say. But the rest is, you have to be not to have the truth, but to be, said Foucault, in the truth, inside what is accepted as truth. Now, this is, of course, also very important as far as cultural theory goes. You can see this. But later his theory changed. The late Foucault then had new ideas about all this, and he thought there is maybe still one principle that goes through everything. And that is, and he had read Nietzsche, of course, he says, is the desire for power. What we find all through is that what controls everything is a will to power that dominates the will to truth, even more important than the will to truth. And he wrote a 3-volume history of sexuality from the antiquity to the to modern times, where he tried to show this historically. Now, my concentration on Europe has, of course, left out something. I know that Britain belongs to Europe, but they are not sure themselves, really, because they speak about us as being on the continent, as if Britain doesn't belong to the continent of Europe. Of course, it is somewhere in between. I don't know where, but anyway. There, of course, people like Raymond Williams and Terry Eagleton and so on had developed a new Marxism with post-structuralist leanings, very complicated. In general, the influence of post-structuralism was not so strong in Britain. They accepted the ideas and took the ideas of Trotsky and Althusser, of Gramsci and other left-wing theorists, and came up with a very interesting theory of literature and theory of interpretation and criticism. And they had there was a difference between what was before and what they did. They brought history again to the foreground. History became more important, but although Marx's theory kept the historical aspect in view now, there was a new movement called New Historicism that became the most important turn, really, after the post-structuralist turn. There is someone on your list called Stephen Greenblatt. You find also one of his works there listed. And there will be a special lecture about New Historicism. One thing is most important about it, they did not try to write about the development of history, let's say, from the Middle Ages to the 18th century and so on, but to take one period and to look at everything that was written at that time, even everything that was done at that time, and then try to find out what were the influences in between, a synchronic kind of view. And they gave a special function to culture as the whole and encompassing thing which even determined literature written at that time. The historians have criticized this. I'm not going into this kind of discussion here. What I haven't mentioned so far is, of course, and some of you may have wondered why this is so, is, of course, feminism and gender studies. A most influential movement that started as a consequence of the 60s, and I mentioned, you will on your list, you will find Kate Millett's study of the from the late 60s about feminism. You will find more recent works by Judith Butler, and you will find some of the French theorists like Julia Kristeva, Luz Irigaray, and Hélène Sissou, who have developed very important theoretical positions starting the whole regarding the whole problem of gendering and also of feminism as it developed first before gender studies. Now, as you will have as another lecture about this very soon, I can leave it at that. In some way, being sympathetic with what Judith Butler had, because she thought that, there is gender discourse, there is gender behavior. It can best be, she says, it can best be made visible by parody, by a parodic repetition that exposes a stable gender identity as an illusion. Now, so far, all these particular theories deserve special attention, and this is also true for what came then, and there's another one where you will have another lecture, and that is post-colonial studies that started really in the 60s. It was Edward Said, you have him on your list, who with his linking of the theory of discourse with politics became most influential for the further development, and Homi Bhabha's introduction of the metaphor of, you may have heard this, hybridity, that is, when people from several cultures live together, come together, form a new culture that becomes mixed. It is a hybrid, not homogeneous, nicht homogen, but mixed. A concept to describe the post-colonial identity best. After colonialism, all these countries that were colonized have a hybrid culture, really. And then there were important concepts developed by post-colonialism, that, like writing back, those colonialized countries writing back, rewriting history or remapping the landscape of what the colonialists had drawn before, a deconstruction of the concept of race, particularly in the United States. And an impressive amount of theoretical work was done in the domain of post-colonialism, just as in the domain of feminist studies and gender studies. Now, with a cultural turn, or rather the whole cluster of cultural turns, we have arrived at the currently dominant kind of theorizing in the humanities. The earliest variety was the interpretive turn, which was based on an American anthropologist's view that culture was to be read like and explained like a text, like a difficult text, so that we as Literaturwissenschaftler or cultural specialists, we could read cultures, we could start reading, and colleagues did that. Then came other turns. Of course, the culturalist turn is, of course, one that then grew in the English departments because of that. Suddenly, it was not just sociologists, it was people who were trained in reading texts that seemed to be best qualified to really study culture. In relativizing Western culture as the post-colonialists had done, you see, one of the art exhibitions in Kassel, not the last one, the one before, was how the other countries, the third world countries, with their conception of art, see ours, the view from abroad. Now, when this came about in post-colonial studies, and with this there came a self-reflexive turn into cultural studies. That is, we started to look at ourselves as if we were ethnologists coming from another culture. A very interesting phase. And then, of course, then came still other movements. I have quite a few listed still here. Particularly Bachmann-Medig, in her book Cultural Turns, she lists a whole lot. Now, there's only one I think I would like to still spend a few words about, and that is, it deserves also special attention because it is not altogether so new. It came out in the 1930s. At a time when the relativizing, that is, post-structuralist said everything is relative, when the relativizing of all kinds of norms and values had created a situation where this could hardly be expected. Already in 1987, the critic Hillis Miller is on your list, in his monograph The Ethics of Reading, sought to show that a deconstructionist reading of literature could be considered still ethical, ethisch, ethical, but with a new twist. Then for the 1990s, one can speak of an ethical turn, with important contributions by theorists of various kinds and applications of various... And I have just put a few on your list. There's a whole lot of it. It's about the philosophy of ethics and truth and the ethics of criticism. The most important turn is this. The question is not only Verbotsethik, like the Zehn Gebote or something like this. Du sollst nicht, you must not. But the question was, yes, but what should I do to lead a good life? The positive question of ethics is, what should I do then? Which brought up Aristotelian norms and so on and so on. Also, in strong influence by philosophers like the famous ethical philosopher Levinas, who thought, well, you know, in order to know who you are yourself, you need the other. And therefore, you also are responsible for, abstractly saying, the other. As we have it in the New Testament, of course, der Nächste. You know, what that means knows everybody who knows a little bit about the New Testament teachings, and you find it there. So it was new and not altogether new. What is important is, of course, there is a distinction between morality and ethics. Morality is a code that is valid in one society. This is what you must and must not do. Ethics is something more. It is a question of what should I do to lead a responsible and good life. And it's something that has been written on, and I have put a few titles there, and you may have noticed that Ethics in Literature by Hadfield, for instance, or the Moral Turn, Ethics and Aesthetics, which is a difficult question, because these are two norms, aesthetische norm and ethische, there are two norms that may conflict sometimes. And I also mention this because a lot of work has been done in the last few years here in Gießen about this, and there are some publications you find on your list, of course. One is Ethics in Culture, edited by Astrid Erl, Ansgar Nüning, and myself, and the second one has just come fresh from the printing press, is Literature and Values, Literature as a Medium for Representing, Disseminating, and Constructing Norms and Values, edited by Sibylle Baumbach, Ansgar Nüning, and myself again. And so you see, this is not only statistics what you saw here on this chart at the beginning, but there are actual works you can buy and study and maybe profit from. I hope so. So I mentioned this towards the end of my survey. Now, I have still one thing to deal with regarding all these turns. What first has to be said is that obviously there has been a flourishing of theory in the last few decades or last 50 years. There's so much that one can hardly survey it. Now, besides the sheer intellectual harvest, what motivation, what excitement, one has to say, there is motivation and there is excitement. You can't believe it, but it is wonderful when you find a new theoretical access to what you treasure, literature and culture. From the outside, the change is so urgently felt and enthusiastically supported, look partly less incisive and less fruitful than the instigator thought, however. When you look back, you say, yeah, but this is all history. Yes, there was deconstruction, but who does deconstruction now? There are still a few good deconstructionists around, but not too many. And the new generation wants to do something else. So you could say, we have had these trends. And on closer examination, this similarity even extends to structural change in the domain of fashion that has taken place in the last decades. Now, what we also have then, when we take fashion as a comparison, we must say that there has been a change. The change is this. Fashion 50 years ago was like this. There were things were either short or long, wide or narrow, for at least 10 years. And you couldn't wear anything else because everybody looked. Mm. Still wearing that, impossible. Now, when you look in the last 10 years or 15 years or so, this is impossible, has become impossible. They come about with a new trend and say, this is a new trend. And it seems that many people don't listen. So you have many trends at the same time. They have competition amongst them. Now, this is also true for theory. There have been so many theories now in the last 20, 30 years around that are competing at the same time. So this taking turns is not a metaphor that is so fantastic anymore. You can take several turns at the same time, let's say. There are many things that are being done, and they are in competition, and maybe they are also not only competitive, but they are also, what should I say? They are also complementations. They give a better overall picture when you take them together. So this is the situation now you have. And of course, many things that are from developments in theory that have been superseded, that were like new criticism, like what you had in the earlier phase, like Lacan, like Deleuze or whatever, you could say this is over. Yes, but it is still something we can profit from. And that is what this whole Ringvorlesung is about. And I'm so grateful to my colleagues, Ansgar Nüning and the whole thing we have here, which you don't have everywhere, to bring back these things and to tell you and to show you that it's still worthwhile dealing with them. There are good and fruitful aspects even when there have been a turn away from them. And this is something I would like to end with, and I was grateful for the opportunity to give you this survey. Thank you.